Okay, sorry, this is the transmission in the New Testament. And I'm Nathan Simmons. So people who made letters or wrote letters, you know, and they were famous for that. I suppose it's a little bit like blogging now. They would copy down, or rather that whoever was writing out their letter for them would copy down the letter in a notebook in addition to the one that they sent out, because then they wanted people to be able to come and retweet them, right? They wanted people to come by and look at their books, look at their letters, and be able to copy that out for their own use, which is one reason, by the way, that we have lots of Cicero's letters. People copied them all over the place. So we'll talk about this a little bit more as we go, but it seems very likely to me, and not just likely to me, thankfully, but to people who are smarter than me and do more of this, that Paul is here requesting Timothy to bring not only his copies of the Old Testament scrolls, but his notebooks that contain the copies of his letters. I think that's very likely. And we'll talk about some other biblical reasons I think that's likely. But I wanted to start here this morning as we talk about a really challenging subject. When we do this in SI, sometimes people get a little terrified, and that's okay. It's an interesting subject, at least. Because I want to show you all the way through this. As we talk about how we go from Paul to us in the New Testament, I want to show you that the church has always been aware of the need to copy Scripture. We talked about this a little bit last week, and you look at Colossians 4, where it says, you know, have this letter read amongst the church at the Laodiceans, and the letter I'm sending there, I want you to read here. Talked about that at the end of 1 Thessalonians, where he says, I adjure you to have this letter read to all the brethren. So we see, and we talked about this a little bit last week, we see a really early copying that's all over the place. The church has a duty to copy the Scripture, and it's a duty they're aware of. But I want you to realize as we go through this morning that text criticism and the transmission in the New Testament is not a modern problem. It's not a problem. It's not an issue that arose in the church just because we're moderns and we love to do archaeology and we can do this sort of thing and we're wealthy and comfortable enough that we can sit around and ask, you know, irritating questions like this. No, it's an ancient trust. The transmission of the New Testament, the copying and the safeguarding of the New Testament and of all of the Bible is something that the church was aware of as early as the writings in the New Testament, and from the very earliest times and the fiercest of persecution all the way through until today. So I want you to come away from this, hopefully not with your head spinning, like, whoa, what are all these manuscripts? What's all this stuff? But with a great confidence that God has providentially entrusted the safeguarding in the New Testament to the church, but the church is aware of that trust. It has sought to copy and to safeguard the text from its very earliest moments till now, and indeed it has done so in a very faithful way. So I want us to see that as we go through this morning. If we see nothing else, I want you to see that we can have a great deal of confidence, not because we have access archaeologically to manuscripts that they didn't maybe have access to for a while, and not because we're so smart and we have such great scholars, but because the church has always valued the very breathed out words of God. It has always sought to copy them, to read them, to use them, and to ensure the fidelity of that copying and reading. So here's an overview. Here's where we're headed. We're going to talk about how we go from Paul to PDFs and YouVersion and everything else. We want to talk about the means of transmission. That is, how did the autographs, the original manuscripts that Paul wrote, get to us today? How were they copied? What did early Christians particularly think about that? We're going to talk a lot about the early church because that's where the break is. If they didn't do it, then we have a break, right? You can talk about, you know, Crossway publishing the ESV, but that's now. That's not 2,000 years ago. We're going to talk about manuscript families and geographic distribution. That is, how was it copied? Where was it copied? How fast was it copied? We're going to talk about some of the particular manuscripts that are really important. We're going to a little meet and greet with some of my favorite manuscripts because I'm a nerd, and hopefully I get to introduce you to some really beautiful copies of Scripture. We're going to talk about the men, and I really want to focus on this, the faithful Christians from the ancient times, from the early church until today, all along the way, who've loved the task of copying the Scripture and preserving the Scripture for us. And then we're going to talk a little bit about the method of textual criticism. That is, how do we think about dealing with variants in Scripture? Why are there variants in different manuscripts? Why are there variations in the copies that we have? How can we think about that? How can we handle that? How do we evaluate those things? So that's where we're headed. We're going to talk about the means of copying, the manuscripts that it was copied with, the men who did the work, and the method of thinking through that. And yeah, I like alliteration. So, because We have headlines like this. This was last year when I was teaching this. Mummy mask may reveal oldest known gospel. Well, that's pretty cool, except the problem is they don't want to break the mummy mask up. So they're trying to figure out how they can use, you know, fancy x-rays and stuff to get in there and get the manuscript out. Because they took a piece of papyrus like this that I'm going to hand around, and they recycled it. They decided, hey, we don't like this one for whatever reason, and so we're going to make it into a mummy mask. And this guy died, so let's turn it into a mummy mask. So the tissue paper, if you will, that's on there is made up of some New Testament manuscripts. And people are saying, hey, we want to read that, but then we'd have to take apart the mummy mask. Well, it wasn't very attractive, so... Last year also, I saw this in the New York Times. Greek New Testament papyrus is discovered. A guy was selling this on eBay for $99. And a professor was like, whoa, can we have that maybe? And he was like, sure, what is it? So it was a really early papyrus fragment with some of the Gospel of John on it. Dates from AD 250 because people can, they look at the handwriting and they say, hey, that's the handwriting that was in use about that time. We'll talk about that in a minute. But I'm handing around a piece of papyrus. It's not ancient, unfortunately. If you guys find one of these on eBay for $99, I'd love to have it. Handing around a piece of papyrus so you can get a look at it. We'll talk about papyrus in a minute. But I want to talk about how we go from a Bible that looks like this, and was written on papyrus, like I'm handing around, to these things that I'll hand around. This is the Greek New Testament, and it's 5th revised edition. This is a critical edition in the New Testament. That means that they took their best guesses from all the manuscript evidence available and put together a text in the New Testament. They said, this is our best guess, our best work at reconstructing the original autographs. And you can look at it. Inside it, it has the text. I know you don't read Greek. It's fine. It has the text. And then underneath it, it has lots of entries, unfortunately, in Latin, which I don't know what to do with that. But it has readings, and then it tells you all of the variants that they've discovered. Now, this is one of two sorts of Greek New Testament that are available today. The other one, here, I'll switch pages here, is called the Novum Testamentum Grace, which nobody ever says. They just call it the NA28. And they share the exact same text. They have the same readings, but they have different textual manuscripts. That is, they tell you about different variants. This one is intended for translators and students who aren't smart enough to do much else with it. And the nice thing about this one is that it doesn't show nearly as many variations. It shows the ones that the committee thought were more important to think through. And it also gives them a rating system. It says, hey, this one, it gives an A. We think this one has got really strong evidence behind it, all the way down to, we don't really know, or it's really bad. So we'll talk about that. We'll talk about the sorts of variants that are in here in a minute. But just so you can look at it, this is the UBS 5, as most people call it, because nobody wants to say the whole long thing. And then this is the Biblia, I should hold it this way because it's Hebrew, the Biblia Hebraica Stuttgartensia. I'm sorry, I'm Germans, it's their fault. This is the diplomatic edition of the Hebrew Bible. And the difference is this one is based on a single manuscript. It's based on the Codex Leningradis, something or the otheris. It's a book that sits in Leningrad in a Soviet or a Russian library. It used to be Soviet. They use that as the base text, and they only deviate from that if they think that they have a really good reason to, that from another manuscript, to vary from it. You can do that for a couple reasons with Hebrew, because they were really, really, really obsessively careful in the way they copied it. And so you can look at a Hebrew manuscript like the Codex Leningradis from the Middle Ages, and you can then look at the Dead Sea Scrolls and see almost zero variation. They're very, very, very careful in their copying. That's not the truth with the New Testament. The New Testament's all over the board. People copy it carefully. They scrawl it down while they were sitting in church, you know, whatever. But there's way more manuscript evidence on the Greek side. So the Greek New Testament has an embarrassment of riches in the terms of manuscripts. We can talk about that. But you guys can look at those. They're kind of cool. Those are the standard original language versions of your Bible. So if you're going to go to Papua New Guinea and translate the Bible into another language, you're going to do it from your UBS 5. You may use their apparatus to say, yeah, I like this reading and I like this reading. We'll talk about the evaluation of that in a minute. But if you're going to go translate the Bible, you're going to base it from that. And your English translations are generally based from those as well. The English Bible is such an amazing thing. We won't have time to talk about this, but the English Bible is such an amazing thing, and the translation committees that go and revise, like the ESV or whatever, they, in essence, they do all this work again on their own. So they have that as a reference, but they're, I mean, the embarrassment of riches behind our English Bible of 500 years of translation and copying and everything may mean that they're not usually based one for one on these. But any serious study is going to be based on those versions of the Bible. So when Chris is preaching, he's using his NA28 as the background for his study, not his English version. So anyway, I already talked about 2 Timothy 4. So let's talk about preservation. What do we mean by preservation or transmission? Either one. I like the word preservation because in my mind, it includes both the copying, the distribution of the New Testament, but it also talks about the safeguarding of the New Testament, whereas transmission just kind of sounds like something in your car in my mind. But and I don't know what to do with that in my car. So from the moment the ink was dry on the original page, on the autograph, when Paul is finished writing, I would argue that the passionate priority of the church knows this, it loves this, it's committed to this, the priority of the church has been to safeguard this great treasure. God's breathed that word. This is the end of our section on the doctrine of Scripture. And I think this is a great place to end because it shows that the church is not only committed to hearing it, to living it, to obeying it, to guarding it theologically, but even in the very means of copying it, the church is committed and was committed, and you can look at the physical evidence for its commitment, its passionate love for the word expressed in its safeguarding and its copying, its distribution of the church, of the word for the widest audience and with the greatest possible precision. So that's what we mean by preservation, is this passionate priority to guard and distribute the word of God. Now, let's talk about the means by which that happens. Before I start on that, questions. Kind of have an idea of where we're going. Questions now, you want to wait for them for different particular parts. If you did reading on this for LBI. All right, well, I'll try to stop as we move through each of these sections. I'm sorry, that's really small. I can barely read it on mine here. So, well, the first thing I want to start with is the longevity, the availability, maybe you could say, of the autographs themselves. A guy by the name of Craig Evans wrote a paper last year after doing a lot of research, and he found that ancient documents were not thrown away as easily as we might think. Sure, they might throw away their bank receipts. That's fine, whatever. I mean, who keeps those after they do their taxes on April 15th? But important letters, even though they're fragile, and you can see with that papyrus that you're talking about really fragile material really early, that they were really good at safeguarding these. Remember, literacy, even though it's rare, is prized, and manuscripts are prized possessions for a lot of people. And he found that just if you just survey the ancient world in general, that a document, an important literary document, could easily stay in use for 75 to 500 years. So he's sitting there reviewing all, not just biblical manuscripts, but all the evidence out there. And he's saying it's not unusual for important literary manuscripts to stay in use and to be talked about. Hey, I used this one and I used it a little later and whatever else for up to 500 years, with 150 years being about the average. And we find that the New Testament has a remarkably stable text. By that, I mean that as you look at the manuscript evidence, and there's tons of it, we'll look at the statistics here in a minute. As you look at the manuscript evidence from the first three centuries, there's variation, as you would expect if you've ever played the telephone game. But can I get a Kleenex? But there is remarkable stability across really broad geographic distribution. So you have a manuscript in Egypt, and you have a manuscript in North Africa that say very much the same things really close to the same time. So there's a great deal of stability in the early church. And that stability in the early text has been an issue of some scholarly questioning. Like, how did this happen? How do we have so much stability so quickly? Well, I would say, if you know that you have these original manuscripts available and that these are the autographs, you're going to check off of that. And they're going to safeguard that. Well, we find that to be true. We find, for example, Tertullian, who lives in about AD 190, so that's 100 years after John writes Revelation, who says, at least if you read him carefully, that the original recipient churches, at least some of the original recipient churches, still had possession of the autographs. In fact, he implies that the autographs to Corinth, Philippi, Thessalonica, Ephesus, and Rome were still in possession of their respective churches. So he actually says, you can go, this is against heretics in his book Against Heretics. He says, if you would indulge your curiosity, boy, I'd like to indulge my curiosity. I'm like, can I go back? Can I go back with my time machine? Go to the apostolic churches in which the very thrones of the apostles are still preeminent in their places, in which their own authentic writings are read, uttering the voice and representing the face of each of them severally. And he tells them, here's the churches you can go to and see these things. Now, again, are those necessarily the original autographs? Maybe, maybe not. But they're certainly very early copies, if not. Another case in 311, Peter, who's evidently the bishop of Alexandria, says, now, it was the preparation about the third hour, as the accurate books have it, and the autograph copy itself of the evangelist John, which up to this day has by divine grace been preserved in the most holy church of Ephesus, and there adored by the faithful. So he's saying 300 years later, you can go see the original copy of John. Now, I don't know if he's telling the truth or not, but the fact that everybody's not like, what? Then gives you, the thought that, hey, maybe he is telling the truth. The point here isn't necessarily that we can go and say with 100% certainty that he has the original copy. We can say that early texts demonstrate a remarkable stability because the church is carefully copying them against copies or original manuscripts that they're safeguarding and they know are important and early. And he's saying this to, not remember, a hostile audience. This book is against Marcion and against the heretics who are going and changing the text in the New Testament, changing the boundaries of the canon. So he's not floating something that he thinks is going to get shot down. He's floating what he thinks is an awfully airtight argument. You can go and look at these things. We can look at the manuscript or at the actual physical evidence that the New Testament writers themselves demonstrate a love for and a dependence on the Old Testament writings. And they quote from the scriptures all the time. They reference them. They encourage their readers to reference them. We talked last week about a canonical core, that is the letters of Paul and the fourfold gospel in Acts that are widely in use in the first couple centuries. To be read in public worship. So we know they're widely in use, not only because they're copied, and we have copies all over the Roman Empire. We'll talk about that again in a minute. A remarkable early and high frequency of copying, but because they tell us we read these things. Justin Martyr, again, in the mid-second century, describes Christian worship service. Maybe we'll read it sometime. It's really a cool thing to read. But he talks about, we read these books. These are the books that we read for a long time. We read them and read them and read them. And in fact, Michael Kruger says, so prominent were the scriptural books for Christians that even their pagan critics noted the Christian predilection for writing and using books, and the rest were forced to reckon with these books in their anti-Christian attacks. So it's something that's so noteworthy in the early church that people can go after them about it. Sounds familiar. We talked about that we find them widely distributed across the empire in the first several centuries. And we find out that the New Testament manuscript copies that we own today have an impressive standardization. That is, that there's a remarkably stable text. But it's not just that their texts say the same things. It's that they use the same sort of handwriting. They use the same sort of, a really remarkable thing, they use the same sort of abbreviations. There's a thing called nomina sacra, sorry for all the Latin, but it basically refers to this habit in the early church of writing, I wish that worked, I don't have one right now, of writing four words, Jesus Christ, Lord, and God, and then by the next couple centuries, about 10 more words after that, but those four words really early, where they would write just the first letter in Greek, just the last letter of the word in Greek, because Greek words change. They change their meaning and their function syntactically by which letter is at the end, so that you have to have both. You have to have both for an abbreviation. You can't do the first two letters because you need to know that last letter. They take the first letter and the last letter, and they write them a little bit larger, and they write a line across the top of them. That's fine. And that abbreviation system for those four words is found in papyri manuscripts like those ones that I showed you as the earliest manuscripts that we have. Dating back to the second and third centuries. So the earliest manuscripts we have from all across the empire all use that same sort of abbreviation system. That tells you that they're busy copying and interchanging these letters with one another. You can't develop, it's not like you can go and say, hey, we've got a new standard for bookbinding, and I just sent out an email. No, they're using them and they're talking to each other. In fact, we don't have time for it. I'm a nerd about these things. But you can actually go and look at them talking to each other and copying books around. Other books that they like to read from the martyrs and stuff that they're saying, hey, send this here, have this copy here. So you could spend a whole seminar on talking about how early Christians copied the New Testament back and forth. But the point from the Nomina Sacra is that they did it, they were talking to each other about it, and there's a massive amount of evidence for it. An embarrassment of riches, as we'll see in the number of manuscripts that are available. Okay, now I guess I better have the hand sanitizer.
Did you say that it could be a letter, a line, and then a letter, they wouldn't actually write out the word that's...
Right, right. They would put the last letter and the first, or the first letter and the last letter and a line over the top. So for, you know, example, for Jesus, they would put, for Iesus, they would put the iota and then usually the sigma and then, is that right? No, usually the upsilon and put a line over the top of it. So if I see one, I have some pictures of manuscripts in a minute. If I see one on there, I'll point it out. Yeah, but the markers don't work usually. I have a picture in a minute, I'm sure. And we talked about this last week too, but the codex form, and I have a slide on this in a second, the codex form of book, as I said, was used by some people as kind of a notebook, but it's not used in big book production until about the 4th or 5th century by the secular world. It's hardly used at all, but the Christians use it all the time. In fact, some people think they invented it because it's so early and so widespread in its use. So the point of all of this is to say that faithful men follow the New Testament example and prioritize the copying and distribution in the New Testament in remarkable volume with unique features and this broad geographic reach. So they're busy doing this. Now, why do we talk so much about the early manuscripts? Well, because they're the earliest witnesses to the inerrant autographs. They give us a link towards our copy. And because they tell us so much about the attitude of the early church, just from things like the Nomina Sacra, things like the fact that they invent a special hand to write them in, a special cursive font, if you will, to write them in so that they can copy them faster. So it gives you an idea of the attitude the early church has just in the physical evidence towards the importance of copying and preserving the New Testament. So you saw my papyrus that I handed around. It's a reed. You can cut it in half and make your little sections of it. But by the 4th century, that's going away because it's just, as you see, it's very fragile. And parchment or vellum really refers to a really, really nice parchment, comes into popular use. So it lasts a lot longer because it's made from, it's basically leather. It's really expensive, though. It's not all that hard to go cut a papyrus reed, cut it in half, and glue it together. It's expensive to take vellum and make a nice manuscript out of it. So they need a lot of things for that to happen. They need it to be popular enough in secular use that the cost comes down, and the church needs to have enough money to actually do it. So one of the reasons we see a big switch towards vellum is not only the fact that all the rest of the culture is using it, but the church is starting, once it becomes legal in the 4th century, the church starts to have enough money to afford to make copies like this. Paper doesn't become popular until the Middle Ages, so most manuscripts that we look at, with the exception of really early papyri, are vellum. Another reason for that is vellum lasts. You can put it in Germany and it'll last, but papyrus dies. It just crumbles away. So most of the papyrus we have is from North Africa and Egypt because nothing goes away in Egypt. It just stays forever. So we have manuscripts. Yeah. Yeah, because it's dry. It's just really, really, really dry. And actually probably a little less upheaval until more recent times. We don't think of Egypt as a really stable place, but it's actually a lot more stable in some ways than, you know, Europe in the Middle Ages. I mean, once the Muslims came through, then you have 1,000 years of stable rule under the Ottomans. So, and unlike modern Muslims, they didn't torch everything in their paths. So we talked about forms already. You can make a roll. You can glue your papyrus together and make a big roll. What's the problem with a roll? Why don't we carry rolls around anymore? Yeah, it's like, it's really hard to get, you know, when Chris says, hey, we're going to do a Bible drill, go flip over, keep your finger here and flip over to the other place. It's just not happening, right? In fact, I think Cicero was talking about how his uncle was trying to hold onto his roll and he dropped it and it fell down the stairs and he was trying to pick it up and he fell down the stairs and broke his hip, which I would presume was a really bad thing back then too. So it's interesting though, but rolls can go to about 35 feet. You can only write them on one side. And guess how long Luke and Acts both are? About 35 feet worth of writing. So if you ever wonder why on earth did Luke split his volumes into two instead of just writing one big book, well, he could fit them on two rolls. Technology was a limitation. So, but the codex we've talked about was really popular early because you can write on both sides. And you can fit the whole fourfold gospel and Acts into one codex. And you can fit all of Paul's letters and oftentimes Hebrews into one codex. And most of the manuscripts we have are of those things, of Paul's letters, or, and then if once they learn that you could take both of those and sew them together to make a fatter book like we do today, you start to see the whole Bible in a codex form. But it's fascinating to me that something that starts as a way of writing letters down, Paul asks for a copy of his letters, as far as I can tell, in that form, and they remain in that form very early and with widespread usage when the rest of the world isn't even using the codex form. And, even more interesting, the church doesn't copy other books that it loves to read in that form. They keep them in rolls. So, for example, The Shepherd of Hermas, which is a horrible book, but interesting reading, and some of the other apocryphal letters, some of just the popular books, First Clement, which is a very popular book by a very early church father, they don't bind them in codex form, and they don't put them in the same codex as they put the canonical books. The codex stays for the canonical books until much later, until the 4th, 5th century. So I think that's very interesting that you see that we love this book, and just from the physical evidence, we're going to prioritize these books. These are the books that we keep in codex form. They also invented a mini codex, like a little tiny one. You'd have to be pretty wealthy, but you could carry it around in your back pocket and do your YouVersion reading plans on it. So, minute handwriting, kind of fat, but, you know, and they couldn't put as much in them, obviously, but there's a lot of those for devotional use that you just don't see replicated at all in the early world. Greek, let me fast forward real quick to one of my manuscripts here. We're not going to get through all this. It's okay. You see how can you guys see that? No, it's kind of dark. But you see how the writing is on there? It looks beautiful, doesn't it? It's a beautiful manuscript. It's these perfect columns. What's the problem with that?
The words aren't the same length.
Yeah, but how do they make these perfect columns if the words aren't the same length? Yeah, they split the words and they get rid of the spaces between the words. Now, the interesting thing is before this time, before about the 400s BC, people wrote in Greek, they would split the words, just like, you know, English does, genuine papyrus sample. But reading is a culturally elite thing to do, generally. There's a widespread literacy, I think, more than sometimes people would give credit for. But reading, if you're going to write and read books and you're going to own books, you're cool, you're elite. And so there's a focus in Greek writing that comes into the aesthetic of writing. They want it to look really beautiful. And so they abandon, like, a common sense way of writing, and they make this scriptio continua, where you just continue to write them without a break so that all the letters look nice in this nice even column. Now, part of the reason for that is they usually read aloud. It was very unusual to read silently in the ancient world. In fact, there's a story that Julius Caesar got a letter once and he read it silently, and his generals, who were all hoping to hear, were very like, oh, wow, he can read silently. And so if you're reading aloud, it's a little easier to break that up. And, you know, you could go do this in English. Go put a bunch of letters together. You can read the words, but it's obnoxious when you're trying to be clear. So it's interesting that the early church then, so this is a quote from Henry Gamble. He says, the ability to rise to this challenge is part of what marked off very skilled readers from others. So if you could actually decipher that with any sort of coherency, you were really cool. So I'm going to have to split this in half. But anyway, but you see that we've already talked about there's this early Christian emphasis on reading aloud to everybody. And so you see that the hand starts to change. The font, the first thing they did, they didn't add spaces, actually, but they started to make greater spacing, bigger letters, but they invented punctuation marks and reading aids to help people read these things aloud. So you see in early Christian books, but not in secular books, reading aids to help people read them aloud, because there's a priority on copying the book for the life of the church, not just because it's beautiful. In the 9th century, so in the 800s, some monks in Asia Minor invented a new hand called minuscule. So here you can see this is majuscule. It's all uppercase. Here's a nomina sacra. This is the word theo. This is the theta. And this is the omega for the God. That's the Greek word for God. So there's the theta and the omega and a line across the top. It's a nomina sacra. They switched from that to this. Oh, which looks like chicken scratch, and I have a very hard time reading it. But it's called minuscule hand. It's a new font and a new hand in Greek, and it let them copy with much less space and much faster. And so you actually see that the pace of book production goes when they do that, because it's cheaper, they can produce more, they can fit more on a single page. And so one of the reasons we have so many manuscripts from the 9th century, 10th century, 11th century that are still really important is because they went back through and remade all their manuscripts as fast as they could. And that's, it's the greatest increase in production until the printing press, because the cost goes way down, the production goes way up, and they're just churning these things out. So you see this huge increase in the number of manuscripts that are available later, not only because of the freedom to do so, but particularly because of the economic impact on that. So one of the things you'll hear is, you know, this idea of the majority text should rule. The most manuscripts, if you count all the manuscripts together and this, all, you know, 400 manuscripts say one thing, one manuscript says the other thing, well, the most manuscripts should win. Well, one of the reasons that's bad, a bad idea, is because by the 9th century, they're sitting there going, how fast can we get them out? You know, and so you have a lot more manuscripts from a lot later. Doesn't mean that they're bad. Some of those late manuscripts, some of those minuscule manuscripts reference right back to the earliest autographs. I'm convinced that some of them go back to 2nd and 3rd century manuscripts, and they say so in their notes. They say, hey, I copied this from something I found in Caesarea that was really, really, really old. So it doesn't mean that a minuscule manuscript is bad. It just means there's a lot more of them. We talked about that, so let's go on. Let's talk about that. So the process of doing all this looks something like this. You have the original autograph that they write, and then you have people copying it. And people copying it, and this is just kind of breaking up the different parts of the Roman Empire. And you see, sometimes, like we just talked about, a manuscript gets copied, you know, from a really early one all the way down to here. And sometimes there's lots of steps in between. So you have this rapid copying, and then, you know, the economic ability to do even more copying, and you end up with various different areas and text forms where you can tell that these manuscripts were copied from other manuscripts because they have similarities in both their notes and the commentaries they include on them, all sorts of things. But you can see that the point of this here is that you have a lot of manuscripts. They're divided into geographic regions, and some of them go way back to early manuscripts. Some of them, there's the space of copying is really condensed. You know, I copied from one that was made 20 years earlier, et cetera. Skip that for a second. So the evidence that we have for putting together these beautiful Greek New Testaments that we have today is actually more than just our Greek manuscripts, because we have the original text copied into New Testament manuscripts. I'll show you some of those in a minute. But we also have some other things. We have translations. We have really early translations into Coptic, into Latin, and there's a whole host of things on here, Georgian, Slavonic, Arabic, Armenian. And so you can go and look. You're saying, hey, which word was original? Did they have this or not? Well, you can go and look, see how they translated it. Now, again, obviously, you've got a little bit of a problem there because it's not Greek anymore. I don't know what happened to my... Let's just turn it off. See if we can get it back. But you can go and see, hey, maybe, for example, the long ending of Mark, did they copy that in a first century translation or not? Is it there or not? So you have, it's a witness to the original text. You also have what they call citations, patristic citations. That's just somebody wrote a letter to their buddy and said, you know, signed it like you do with a verse. So you can recreate the entire New Testament from patristic citations by like the 3rd or 4th century. They're copying it and referencing it in their letters so much. You know, you could go read somebody like Clement, and his letter is full of citations from the apostles. So you can go look at other people's citations of things and use that as well.
When I cite things, I don't always do it verbatim.
And they don't either, which can be a problem. So, but again, there's a lot of it going on. There's millions of citations. So you look at it and you go, huh, that's interesting. Why did they cite it like that? So that's exactly the problem we're going to talk about. You have there, that introduces a form of variation into the witness we have of the text. Then you're going to have a method for evaluating that and saying, is this right or not? And you have to say that somebody's been evaluating that all the way along. I hope it's not just started evaluating it now, because if it hasn't been safeguarded all along, you have trouble. So let's do this. Let me talk about these different manuscripts a little bit, and we'll see where we are on time. But I think we'll talk about the men and the method of this next week. That'll split it in half, and we won't go real long then. We'll see how we do here. This is a pretty quick section. It's about 25,000 witnesses to the text in the New Testament up until the Middle Ages, which is where I stopped counting. I'll tell you why in a minute. It's about 5,700 Greek manuscripts of various forms and various completeness from the late 1st century until the Middle Ages. And there's about 19,000 translations that we have manuscripts of. And then the other versions, people's prayer books, people's letters, whatever else. And then, of course, the citations in other writers, there's millions of quotations. There's literally millions and millions. So it's an embarrassment of riches. Sometimes you'll hear people say, well, you know, the first manuscript of something like Homer is 4 years later and there's only 3 or 4 copies. That's, I don't like that argument. If you talk to an expert on Homer, they're going to tell you that's not true. So if you hear that, you're just kind of, whatever. But there is an embarrassment of riches in New Testament stuff way beyond other books. Not all those manuscripts are as important. Some are particularly significant. And most of those are very early because they're in the attitude toward copying the text. But some of them are late. There's some really important minuscule manuscripts, as I said, that both look the same with the same variations as really early manuscripts and say, hey, I copied this really early manuscript. Manuscripts. We have those that are written on papyrus, so we call them papyri, not real original. And those are very significant because they're really early, but we don't have very many of them, and they're usually fragmentary because papyrus is really fragile. We have majuscule manuscripts, that big copied hand, usually in Scriptio Continua, and those are usually very significant because they're early. Usually they're the 4th through the 6th century, and they're often very complete, which is helpful. And then there's literally thousands of minuscule manuscripts once they changed the handwriting, were able to up the production. And most of those date, obviously, from after the 9th century when they invent it into the early Middle Ages. So let's look at a couple. This one is really important. It's P52, Papyrus 52. The naming conventions are not real thrilling. This is in the John Ryland's Library in England in Oxford, and it dates to the late 1st or early 2nd century. So we're talking the 90 to 100 to 110 age range, if you listen to some scholars. It's really, really early. It's really small. It's only 3 leaves. But it does 2 things for us. It gives you fragments from John 18 and 19. And we know from a lot of different sources that John wrote his gospel likely in Ephesus, but this was found in Egypt. And it's found in Egypt less than 100 years later. So that tells you that there's rapid geographic distribution of his letter. So I think that's very interesting. Somebody put it on a ship and copied it over there and read in Egypt in Oxyrhynchus. So it's really cool because it's really old. It's the earliest New Testament manuscript that we have.
So that one won't be $99
on eBay. No, that one is quite literally priceless. And the bottom in the P46, this is a really, I picked a really bad picture because it looks like there's not much of it. There's actually all of Romans, Hebrews, the Corinthians, etc., of Paul's, except for portions of Romans and 1 Thessalonians, and all of 2 Thessalonians got ate up. I don't know what happened to it, but it vanished. So they can tell it was there because you can look at a book, you know, and they don't have page numbers, but you can tell what should be fitting in the book. It's just damaged and gone. And this is from about AD 200, and it's a copy of all of the Pauline writings. Really, really important because it gives you a really early witness to Paul, and it's really beautiful. It's just not the picture that I put up there. It's very beautiful. Now, when we move to vellum or parchment manuscripts, this is the queen. This is Codex Sinaiticus. It's the oldest complete New Testament. It once included the entire Old Testament, still does to some extent. When I was in London in the spring, it was open, unfortunately for me, to Jeremiah, which I cannot read the Greek of the Septuagint because the vocabulary is very different. But it has almost the entire Old Testament. Some of it was lost because they started cannibalizing the manuscript to use it for other things, to write other things or to start fires and stuff. So it was discovered in the late 19th century. Since I'm not going to go on to the next section of this, I'll tell you a little bit of the story because it's a great story. There's a guy, we'll talk about him next week. His name's Constantine Tischendorf, and I'm sorry, it sounds like a sneeze, but he's a German guy, and he was determined to recover as many early manuscripts as he could, and he was on a trip through, he'd already had quite a bit of fame for some other manuscript things. He took a trip to Egypt. He went to this monastery, St. Catherine's Monastery in the Sinai Peninsula. He had to get a letter of introduction because the monks were very... And he went up there and he was looking around in the library. He's chatting with the second in command dude. And he saw, because I'm an expert on manuscripts, he sees this really, really old manuscript. And it's portions in the New Testament. He saw about 80 leaves of it. And it looked to him that they were putting it in the fire and reusing portions of it. And he's like, hey, can I check that out? That's really cool. And they were like, no, maybe it's really valuable. Maybe we shouldn't have shown you that. We'll go put it away. About, I think it's like 15 years later, he finally, after a failed another trip, he tries again, nothing happens, they won't show him anything, they don't want to talk to him at all. He thinks maybe somebody else got there and beat him to it. Finally, he decides, you know what, I'm German, they don't like Germans very much, but they really like the Tsar of Russia because he's Orthodox. and maybe if I get the czar to give me a letter, they'll let me come back and look at it. So he gets a letter from the czar, he goes back, and he decides, I'm going to be real careful about this time. And he goes out for a walk with the head of the library, and they come back, and they're talking about the Septuagint, which is a Greek translation of the Old Testament. He's telling them about some cool Septuagints he read, and the librarian's like, I have a Septuagint too. You want to see it? He's like, yeah, I guess. So they hand it to him, and it's got not only the Septuagint, it's got the entire New Testament, which he suspected was there, but and the Epistle of Barnabas, which had never been copied before, and Shepherd Firmus. And he's like, it's late. Can I take this back to my room? And they're like, yeah, sure. So he goes back to his room, and he's like, oh, I'm going to write down everything I can. So then he says, can I take it to your, like, sub-monastery in Cairo where I can copy it down? Because he doesn't think they're going to let him keep it. They're like, okay. So he goes out there, and he grabs a pharmacist and a doctor who both spoke Greek, and they transcribed the entire thing in, like, 3 months. Because he's like, I got to write it down, even if I don't ever get a copy of it. Then he has to go get another bishop elected, because they've got this whole stalemate. So he gets the czar to get another bishop elected. And the bishop says, I'll give it to the czar if the czar will give me a lot of money. So the czar gives him a lot of money. He takes it back to Germany, and he's able to bind it in these beautiful, beautiful copies, facsimile copies of it. And some of those are still around today. And then the Russians decided they didn't care about the Bible anymore in the 1920s. And the British, who liked to collect everything on the planet, said, hey, can we buy it? And they said, sure. So most of it sits in the British Library today. If you go to London, you can go right by St. Pancras Station, walk inside, and it's sitting there in their reading room. It's a complete New Testament. It dates to about 330. It probably was commissioned by, the emperor? Yeah, Constantine. Who asked Eusebius, it's on the slide, isn't it? Who asked Eusebius of Caesarea to give him 50 manuscript Bibles for all of his major churches. So he cranks, they probably cranked this guy out. It's huge. The manuscript pages are like this big. You know how much money that costs to make a big, beautiful manuscript like that? Well, Eusebius is like, oh my gosh, this cost a lot of money to make this big, beautiful manuscript. I can't make 50 of these things. I cannot afford to send 50 of these things. In fact, he couldn't even get enough vellum to supply 50 of these things. So he's like, whoa, this is not going to work. You do not send the emperor the big, beautiful one and then say, except the rest, the other 49 don't look so good. So likely he says, well, let's not send him that one. Let's send him another one. This is Codex Vaticanus. It's a lot smaller. It's beautiful. It's beautifully done, but it's a lot smaller. It's a much smaller manuscript. And the theory by people who are a lot smarter than me, one of the theories, is that Sinaiticus was supposed to be the first of those, but it didn't work out. And so it just sits around in Caesarea for another couple hundred years because there's an early corrector. You can see where somebody went through and said, oop, you missed the letter or whatever. And then there's a later corrector from about the 6th century. And then it makes its way where it sits until Tischendorf shows up in the 19th century. And then Vaticanus vanishes. In the library as early as 1481, but we don't know how it got there. It seems that it got there as a gift because they talk about gifting manuscripts. By gift, they mean, we'll give you this if you give us a lot of money because we're really cash-strapped. When the Western and Eastern Catholic churches were talking about reunifying. So it's likely got there in about the 1430s. Manuscripts were becoming cool again, so maybe that's when they gave it to him. But nobody got to see it for a really long time. The Pope didn't let anybody look at it. Tischendorf, because of his fame from Sinaiticus, he tried a couple times before, and they're like, no, we're making an edition of it. We don't want you to look at it. And finally, he was so famous, and the Pope had written a really nice letter. Tischendorf was solidly evangelical, by the way. But the Pope had written a really nice letter for Sinaiticus, and he's like, come on, you got to let me look at it. So they're like, okay, we'll let you look at it for 3 hours a day. And then in those 3 hours, he produced the first edition. He'd go back and memorize it, write it down. So he went, now it has its own website. You can go look at it, which is cool. Most of these manuscripts, the really cool ones, have their own website, which is pretty awesome. You can go home and look at Codex Sinaiticus online, and just beautiful. So we'll talk about next week. Let me read the summary here because we're done with this section. The recovery, study, and publication of these major early 4th and 5th century codexes. So Sinaiticus, Vaticanus, Alexandrinus, we didn't talk about it. It's from Alexandria, obviously, and Clarimontanus, which is all of the Pauline letters. And the early 19th century gives us another link back to the early church, back to that time when we were saying that the manuscripts are still, the autographs are likely still in service, right? These are expensive, they're beautiful, they're fact-checked. But the recovery of the papyri in the next century, in the 1900s, gives us a way of establishing their faithfulness, because we have these 4th and 5th century manuscripts that are incredible, but we don't have that link. How early do these go? But now you have a fragment of P52 from John 18 and 19, and you can go and look and go, wow, P52's John agrees almost exactly with the John that we have in this complete manuscript from Sinaiticus. So it gives us a link back to that. On top of other nice things, there's so many papyri, you can find people's receipts, their grocery lists, all the stuff, that it gives you a really good feel for early Koine Greek's grammar and vocabulary, which is cool. And so if the autographs can reasonably be expected to be preserved for at least 150 years, and the text of the autographs is referred to by the fathers as late as 190, and you have all these papyri and then the major codices from the 4th and 5th century, you have a lot of warrant for believing that we have a really carefully preserved New Testament. For next week, the problem with that is that's just science. That's just critical thinking. That there's warrant, that is, it's a reasonable thought to say that this looks like it was preserved carefully. But I'm not satisfied with that. I don't think that's enough. I think you need something else. I think you need, because you have people out there saying, well, the church is copying it, but it's changing it to suit its needs. It's doing whatever. Maybe they're just copying it to make money. Maybe they're not paying really good attention. I think you need something else. I think you need to see not only in the New Testament that the early church was concerned about this, but that from then until now, there are faithful Christians at every stage. And you can find, we're going to walk through this from the first century until this century, Christians who are concerned about and careful about and aware of the fact that they need to be preserving the manuscripts, that variants can creep in, that they can correct them, that they can check them. And we'll see that we'll walk from the first century till now and men who are careful to do that, to preserve the New Testament for us. And then we'll look at how do you deal with the variants that there are there? How do you put together a framework for dealing with the variants that we do have, because inevitably there are variants in the reading. So we'll talk about that next week. Thanks for your patience. I went 3 minutes long, but if you have questions, you can hit me up now. I'll hang around and then I'll go quiz. So thanks.